It's such an honor, Danny, to be part of this amazing podcast you're doing here, and it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
Your podcast is the one that I listen to when I want to listen to an interviewer who has A, actually read the book she's asking questions about, and B, asks really interesting, insightful questions about it, and I think that's really special.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
It was a good chat, great chat. You're a good interviewer.
It's an absolute pleasure to be interviewed by a very articulate person such as yourself.
I've so enjoyed listening to the podcast. Truly, I love it. And it does just feel like you're having a chat with your mate.
That's brilliant what you do. Honestly, I'm so in awe, and we need more word nerds like yourself.
Welcome and thank you for listening to Words and Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Danny V. On this podcast, I chat with authors about their books and the writing process, social and political issues that impact the writing and how literature can change the world. You can listen to Words and Nerds Podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud, where you can also leave a review, and you can follow the podcast on Twitter, Instagram or Facebook. Thank you to Christopher Dicker for the beautiful intro and outro. You can find Christopher on Instagram and YouTube. Today I welcome freelance writer, journalist and novelist John Newton. We talk about the oldest foods on earth, a history of Australian native foods. This is a book about Australian food, not the foods that European Australians cooked from ingredients they bought with them, but the flora and fauna that nourished the Aboriginal peoples for over 50,000 years. It is because European Australians have hardly touched these foods for over 200 years that John is writing about it now. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Words and Nerds podcast, John. I'm pretty keen to chat about the oldest foods on earth, Australian native foods, recipes and sources. It is actually my very first venture into a recipe book.
Yeah, is it a recipe book? That's the first question. The reason that this book, and I think it's a good, well, this one should have recipes, but the first one, the oldest foods on earth, that which was basically a history of our relationship. When I say our, I mean non-Indigenous Australians' relationships with native foods, and what our neglect of them did to the Indigenous population was more of a history book. But my very wise publisher said, "I want recipes in it, otherwise the booksellers won't know where to put it." And I think that's a very wise thing. This one is, of course, more of a recipe book than the first one.
But it isn't solely a recipe book as well, and that's what I liked about it, because it was full of interesting information and history, and some things really surprised me. I think the biggest thing that surprised me was that out of 6,000 edible plants in Australia, non-Indigenous people used less than 50.
That's right. Yeah, I'm probably a little bit more now, I don't know, but yes, we've got a lot of catching up to do. With our Indigenous plants, 230 years of ignoring them and neglecting them have cost us dearly, actually, because we need to work on our understanding of and use of these products, and not just plants either. I mean animals. You know, the animals we don't eat. I mean, I'm not a vegetarian. I don't know what you are. I'm an omnivore, and there are some wonderful animals that we don't eat.
And why do you think we've gone this way? You know, we don't eat a lot of Australian plants or animals. I mean, kangaroos gaining popularity. Yep. And sometimes you can get a crocodile or an emu pie if you go somewhere touristy, but they're not staples of our diet, are they? Why do you think we've ignored these, or we're sort of don't know about them?
Well, that's a long and complex story, which begins with the people who came here in 1788. Who actually styled themselves as the lords of the earth, the Georgian people of England. They were the most important people in the world as far as they were concerned, and they not only set out to ignore the people who were here, to pretend they weren't here. They then, over the many years, decided that they were nothing but savages, ignorant savages, and that was the beginning of it. So whatever they ate wasn't really worth eating. In the early days of the colony, there was some eating of foods. Watt Contench pointed out that they missed their tea. So they love the native sarsaparilla. So they used to gather that and brew that as tea. And as things got a bit more difficult in terms of bringing in real food from the other side of the earth, they would occasionally eat kangaroo because they had to. And then there were all sorts of experiments from all sorts of strange people. There was a society for acclimatization of foods, which went both ways. There were foods that were sent from Australia to the old country, and the acclimatization society also attempted to eat foods that were here. And in my first book, there's a wonderful account of a dinner that was held in the mid 18th century. Where there were recipes for wombat and all sorts of native animals, but they were surprised to discover, of course, that some of the things they ate were really marvelously delicious. For example, the magpie goose, which we could be eating now if we can get it down here and get it out of the country. So they were surprised by how good these foods were. But they were still treated as a kind of a novelty. It was a novel thing, and it was sort of food that you ate while you were waiting for the real stuff to arrive from the old country, all the real food to be grown on the farms that we brought here, the farms that utilised agriculture that have been absolutely disastrous from this country as we can tell now.
And not a lot has changed, because when you say that these are novelty foods, in some ways a lot of Australian native food still remains that way, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. When my first interest in this was, if you can go back to my history with this, I mean, I'm a white fella. I had no connection growing up with Indigenous Australia. I grew up in a place called Double Bay. So, you know, I didn't know many Indigenous Australians until a certain point in my life. But in 1993, I was a food critic for the Sydney Morning Herald. And in 1993, I ate a kangaroo dish cooked by a wonderful cook called Philip Searle at a restaurant called Oasis Syros, which was a great restaurant. And Philip was a fearless cook. And he cooked this beautiful kangaroo dish with a sauce of spiced beetroot, which I just loved it. And having eaten it, I thought, that's the only native Australian food I have ever eaten. Except, like most Australians, I'd eaten macadamia nuts. But, of course, we didn't know they were native because they weren't called by their original names, like bindle. They were called macadamia nuts after a Scottish person who was a friend of the person who discovered the macadamia nut. Yes, he did, of course, he discovered it. So I then began to think about the fact that we lived here, and I wonder what other foods there were to eat. So I started the exploration, which ended up in the book. But along the way, I discovered also, by talking to the restaurateurs who had been around for some time and were, by the time that I wrote the first book, they had all gone out of business, because the food was seen as tourist food, as novelty food, rather than as real food. And it was very sad, because those people told me, and I was only speaking to one of them who became a friend of mine yesterday, Janice Kirsch, the people who came from overseas, the foreigners who came into the country, the Americans and the Europeans, loved the food. They loved the flavours. But we didn't like them, and our critics, our food critics, sneered at them. Of course, many of those food critics are now suddenly jumped onto the bandwagon and are saying how wonderful they are.
And it is gaining some momentum in restaurants. Can you tell us about, you know, which restaurants you know of, because I know you mentioned them in your book, that do cook with these native ingredients?
Well, as I said, when I started the other book, when I was writing the other book in 2015, there weren't any real native food restaurants around. But as I put the finishing touches to this book, in early 2019, there were 18 major restaurants using native foods. And that included, of course, the Gourmet Traveller 2017 Restaurant of the Year, which is Arana in Adelaide, and the 2019 winner, Key in Sydney, Peter Gilmore. Peter Gilmore was a very enthusiastic user of native Australian produce. And 7 out of the 10 top restaurants from the Gourmet Traveller 100 restaurants in Australia in 2019 were using native Australian foods. That's been a big change. But the point of this book, of course, is to get us to use them at home.
Mm-hmm.
The wonderful story of Birkin Wills, who died rather than accept the food that was offered to them by the people that they had landed amongst. And they landed amongst those people at a time of great plenty. But it was a time in that part of the world where there were fantastic animals, and there was a wonderful crop of foods, and there were fish, and other indigenous clans flocked to the place, and they were having great feasts. Birkin Wills turned up and just completely ignored them and told them to bugger off and consequently died.
That is insane, isn't it?
Well, it is a bit silly, yes.
Wow. And you do talk about foraging in your book, which I found, you know, really intriguing. I'd be too scared to forage. I definitely would not trust myself to not poison myself. But you do talk about foraging, and what are the do's and don'ts for foraging? And I'm not encouraging people to do this without, you know, extensive knowledge, but your advice?
Yeah. My advice would be, if you're going to forage, to go out with someone who knows what they're doing, and that would probably be an Indigenous bloke or woman. They will help you to choose what you can and what you can't pick. There are a couple of other people. I mean, my first foraging trip was done with a guy called Vic Cherikov. And Vic is a bit of a hero in this story. He was sent out to the rest of Australia by the University of Sydney, the Human Nutrition Unit, to gather native foods to bring them back to the Human Nutrition Unit so they can study them. And Vic became, and still is, a great expert on these foods. And he took me to a patch of sclerophyll, pretty ordinary forest, just off a main road in Ryde, and we walked into this forest, and within minutes he had shown me 10 things to eat.
Wow.
Which I wouldn't have even known were there. And that's the thing that we must realise. I mean, it is a great shame that we know little about these things, but it is, as you have said, it is getting a little bit better. It's still got a long way to go. Don't forget, 230 years of neglect. It's not going to happen overnight.
Mm, yeah. Now, when you were foraging, was there some fear in that, or did you trust your guide completely?
I trusted Vic completely. I knew his level of expertise. You talked about do's and don'ts. Well, don't just go out on your own, blunder around, pick things and eat them. Because Vic pointed out to me later on, and I think it's in this book too, and I've forgotten the exact story. There's a certain piece of produce that can have a fungus on it which is deadly, which you can't tell.
Okay.
You just got to be very careful. And the other thing you've got to be careful of course, is that when you do go out, Mike Cormby, who is a great horticulturalist who grows these foods for consumption. He goes out always with the elders, and they will help him to pick the one that isn't endangered or isn't in danger of being wiped out. So mm-hmm. you take this one, don't take that one.
Mm, which is important to consider as
well.
It is important.
Mm.
Now, I wanted to go down the path of nutrients and medicine because I find that fascinating, and I do believe in Western medicine and science, but I also like the idea of food as medicine. I think in our modern world with so much packaged food and so much processed food, I think we need to bring ourselves back to this a little bit. And in the book I read, you know, things like Davidson plums and Illawarra plums and ryeberry and finger limes, they're also rich in nutrients.
That's right.
Now, are these nutrients missing from a modern diet because we're not eating them?
They are not so much missing from a modern diet. They aren't as abundant in modern foods, in Western foods even, as they are in native foods. And this is something that was part of this is something, of course, that was started by Vic Cherikov when he started bringing these foods back. And it was taken up by a wonderful woman who worked with the CSIRO called Dr. Isabella Konchak. And she started to do a lot of the research into the nutrient levels of these foods and discovered that they have extraordinarily high levels of nutrients. And the interesting thing about that, of course, is that when we think of superfoods, we think of these, you know, goji berries and some of these other foods that are all exotic and they all come from somewhere else. But in effect, the foods that could be called superfoods, which have the most, and you mentioned Kakadu plums or gubbins, they have more vitamin C than any other fruit on earth.
Wow.
Now, they're a little bit challenging because what the overall thing about these native fruits is they're not incredibly sweet. They tend to be more tart than sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mind that. I quite like that. But we haven't started to look at, for example, with the Kakadu plum, we haven't started to look at the amazing varieties of different kinds of native Kakadu plum that grow. And one woman I spoke to who gathers them, Pat Torres, said she had one variety that she gathered, which was, had a little tiny, this is one of the problems with the Kakadu plum. People complain that it has a very large pit, very thick skin and very little flesh. She said, well, there's one that I gather that has a very small pit, thin skin and beautiful, thick, abundant flesh. So once again, having ignored these things for 230 years, we just haven't bothered to select those best of that we've done with our own food, with our own Western foods.
And you've also listed some foods in your book too that are widely used and effective for medicine: the beach bean, the gumby gumby, lemongrass,
yep,
and the kangaroo apple. Have you had any experience with this, or heard of other people's experiences? You know, to be researched, and you've got aches and pains and blood pressure. I mean, it's quite amazing, isn't it?
Well, two things to think here. First of all, these people have been around this continent for 60,000 years, and they have had success with using many of these foods and herbs as medicines, and we have to start to look at that. Secondly, I suppose we have to validate them in our Western system and find out what it is that makes them work, and that work is beginning. But once again, it's beginning after ignoring them for a very long time. And the scientists are starting to look at some of these foods, like the gumby gumby especially, and trying to find out, is there any, well, that's a bit condescending, how it works rather than is there any reality, yeah, in the fact that it does work.
Yeah,
because some of them do work. I mean, there are what they call, sort of folk medicines that don't really work, and folk medicines that do really work.
Mm, absolutely, because that's where science derived, isn't it? Getting things from nature,
oh, yeah,
and creating,
sure,
things. And
yeah.
Mm, interesting. Now, I have to ask you about the witchetty grubs. I need to ask you about, I mean, you've got witchetty chocolates as well. Have you eaten a witchetty grub?
No, I never have, and not because I don't want to. I've just never been in there. I've never been around them.
Mm.
I would have absolutely no problem in eating a witchetty grub, and I'd love to eat a witchetty grub. And I'm going to have to go out and find one and eat one.
I think you are.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's a terrible thing to admit.
The best way to prepare it, because there's in your book there's witchetty chocolates, but I was actually thinking before I read it, like maybe wrapped in bacon or something.
I don't know. I mean, that's interesting. I would imagine that, like most of these things that Indigenous Australians eat, they don't have very elaborate methods of preparation.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing to do with a witchetty grub, I'd imagine, is to throw it into the ashes of the fire, pull it out, and eat it. Yeah. I mean, I have eaten kangaroo that mm-hmm. way.
Yeah.
There was an event 2 years ago. And the chef who was running the food for that event did a big sort of what we know is a hangi, what the New Zealanders call a hangi, which is a ground fire. And he threw a whole kangaroo on top of that.
Wow.
And turned it. And then we went up to it and we just pulled pieces off and ate it. It was delicious.
Wow. Yeah. What is the most wild thing you've eaten?
Wild thing in terms of...
I don't know, odd thing, that's not, you know, widely eaten in the world.
Well, I suppose going back to that wonderful kangaroo, that wonderful magpie goose, mm-hmm. which is now mainly from the Northern Territory. Now, I happen to love duck. I'm a great lover of eating duck and cooking duck. But the kangaroo, the magpie goose that I ate at Jean-Paul Brunetto's Riveries restaurant many years ago now, it stayed in my mind. It was absolutely beautiful. But we can't get it. We can't get it down here very easily. I've got a thing in the book. I've got a place in the book where you can ring a number in Adelaide and get magpie goose breasts frozen, sent to you. But we should be able to get the whole fresh birds. But it's just a very difficult process. It will happen. Have you come across the brush turkey?
Yes, I have.
You have. And everyone thinks that they're a terrible pest. They are apparently delicious. Now, I haven't eaten them because they're protected. But Mrs. McClacken, I've forgotten her name now, she wrote that she served them to her guests as pheasant, and they didn't know the difference.
Wow. And it's all about mindset, isn't it? Because when you look at other cultures and countries, my family derived from Holland, and they eat something called paardenvlees, which is horse. And to the average person, it sounds... you know, terrible. But
do you eat horse?
I have tried it when I went to Holland. Okay. And the thing is, I don't know if I wasn't a fan of it because I knew it was horse. And it's in your head, you know. And to get around it, because it doesn't make sense. Because if you're going to eat cow and you're going to eat bacon, well,
why not eat horse? Exactly. I've eaten horse, and I don't much like it. But I have an Italian chef friend who adores it.
My dad likes it, and my grandmother, my Oma, she was eating ox's tongue, and that was all. I mean, that was back in the days when you did head to tail, which is good, and we should be doing head to tail.
Well, as is said, it is only a courtesy to the animal to eat the whole thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's interesting, and I think it's a mindset rather than because I was brought up with going, no, you ride horses and they're in farms. You don't eat them. So when you go somewhere else, it's about getting your mind around it, I think.
It is. And of course, the strange thing about going back to the brush turkey, it's first of all, it's seen as a pest and a nuisance. And secondly, it's protected.
Mm.
So... It's a dichotomy. Why, if it's seen as a pest, why not corral them and farm them and eat them to keep them, you know, to keep the numbers down, to keep them away from your gardens? They are a pest in the garden. I mean, I caught one on top of my I live in Glebe, and I caught one on top of my shed in the back of the house, and I was very concerned because I have fish.
Mm.
And I didn't know whether he was a fish eater. I discovered he wasn't a fish eater, but I shooed him away.
You didn't put him on the dinner plate and tell everyone it was pheasant?
I mean, first of all, it's illegal, and secondly, I wouldn't be able to kill him, you know, and dress him.
Yeah, that's the part, isn't it?
I'm a city bloke.
I agree. Now, we talk about we wanted to bring these native foods into our kitchens and normalise them a little bit. So what are the hot tips for either growing your own native food at home? We've got a little veggie patch where I live, but, you know, we grow very common things, you know, tomatoes and spinach and lettuce. But what's some advice for people at home who want to give these things a crack?
Advice would be to find someone, and there is a list in the back of the book of native plant nurseries, to find someone who sells native plants, and then collaborate with them, because it depends where you live.
Mm-hmm.
I have two lily pilly trees in my a little patch of ground behind my house in inner city Glebe. And they grow very well. Now, the third year I had them, they gave me a fantastic crop. Then the years subsequent to that, not much of a crop. This year I had the most beautiful, abundant fruit buds on the trees. And I was really looking forward to having another, you know, another big crop of ribberries. And then overnight, they were just completely and utterly decimated, or decimated worse, just completely and utterly destroyed by a moth.
Oh, really? And so, excuse my ignorance, but yeah. Off lily pillies, are they ribberries?
They are, that's right. Lily pillies are the tree, ribery is the
fruit. I've got them in my backyard, and
well, there you go.
I realised that we could eat them because I looked it up, and worse, I'm already growing native plants in my backyard.
You're already on the way. And if you're getting a good crop, there's a recipe of mine for a ribery relish in that book.
Oh, fantastic.
And it's a really lovely thing to have with duck, with chicken, with all sorts of meats.
Well, I can start this weekend because I was going to ask you, actually, what recipe would you recommend for the novice?
Oh, well, the ribery relish, if you've got the ribberies going there. There's a lovely recipe from one of the indigenous women who contributed to the book, which is fallen iho, which is a simple... It's a macadamia crumbed fish fillet with lemon myrtle. Now, lemon myrtle is a fantastic, it's an amazing plant.
That sounds delicious. And lemon myrtle, is it anything like a lemon?
Well, no, it's a leaf. You use the leaf.
Yeah, but the flavour-wise? The
flavour is lemon-like, but much, much more intense and much and different and much more savoury. It's a wonderful thing. Also, of course, each of our bathrooms, we've got two bathrooms in the house, they've both got lemon myrtle sprays to deodorise the bathroom.
Yeah.
Lemon myrtle soap is fantastic stuff. So it's a wonderfully versatile plant, and the lemon myrtle is a beautiful thing to use in cooking.
I think I'm going to give that fish one a crack. That sounds delicious.
Yeah, and Fiona Porteous has a, I quite like tofu. I mean, you know, when I say I'm an omnivore, I do eat everything. I don't just eat meat. She has a lovely recipe for mountain pepper tofu. Now, mountain pepper is another terrific ingredient, Tasmanian ingredient. It's a very, very hot pepper. It's a very, very old plant. It dates back to Gondwanaland.
Wow.
And it's lasted all this time. And the mountain pepper is that you can have the little pepper, pepper berries, or the leaves. Again, it's a very, very hot. I wouldn't try it on the kids. But it's a different to a chili heat. It's a long, deep heat.
Okay.
And that's wonderful. And that's also wonderful with kangaroo.
Well, some hot tips there. I'm happy about that. Yeah. I wanted to try something from there. I wasn't sure where to start. So I think the macadamia fish, lemon myrtle, I think that's a good start. You know, we touched on the fact that you write on food, eating, travel, farming, and associated environmental issues. And I had to ask you, in the middle of this awful bushfire crisis that we're experiencing in Australia, and it doesn't have to relate to this, but I did want to touch on the environment. And because you have written about the environment, environmental issues, what concerns you particularly today? Or I know probably many things, but what's one issue that's on your mind about environmental issues?
One issue that's on my mind is, again, in the way that we've totally ignored Indigenous people, the quite disgraceful way that we rejected the Uluru State from the Heart. We do not collaborate with the people who have been here for 60,000 years and have learnt how to deal with fire and how to minimise the problem of fire. These fires we're having now would never have happened before 1788, because we've totally changed the landscape and we've totally changed the way we deal with the landscape. Now, this is part of the problem of bringing in that absurd, you know, this totally inappropriate Western, Northern, you know, European agriculture. So what I would love to see, and what I'm working on with a group of people, is that the next time, when this horrible period is over, that nationally we put together a kind of a wartime cabinet, if you like, because it is a war. It's a war against the climate.
It is.
And we involve the Indigenous Australians from all around the country to work with us on how we can minimise the risk of fire. And this is already happening in Victoria, apparently. The Victorian government is already collaborating with their Indigenous people on that basis. But it should be happening across the country. It should happen right around the country.
That is, Bruce, such a great point, and such an obvious one, isn't it?
Bruce Pascoe, there's a wonderful, he spoke on the ABC, which is available. I'm not too sure it's a science show, but anyway, if you look Bruce Pascoe, go to your Google, Bruce Pascoe, ABC, Indigenous Fire Management, and you'll get this, it was on iRadio National Breakfast. Mm-hmm. He spoke to Pat Cavellis on this. And he gives a basic rundown on the ways in which this was done. And it's a lot. It's going to be long, hard, and difficult to do. But if we don't do it, we won't have a country. Mm. And we don't want to kill any more of these beautiful wild animals.
I know. It's heartbreaking, isn't it?
No, it's just terrible.
It is. Well, I'm sorry to end on such a somber note, but I did want to bring up the environment because it's something that's on everyone's mind at the moment. But thank you so much. I just loved this little book. I love everything about it. I love the pages and how they feel. I'm such a book nerd. I love the size of it. And, you know, I just learned so much, and not only from reading it, but from chatting with you. And I think that's the greatest thing you can take away from any piece of art, is that you enjoy it and you also learn from it. So thank you so much. And when I do give that recipe a crack, I shall let you know and put a photo out
please,
there.
Please, please do. And again, thank you for the very informed talk. And go back to the other book too, because the other book is interesting as well.
Yeah, I will. And I think it's so important that we go back to basics. And I try and keep away from packaged food as much as possible, because I just don't think it's doing any of us any good. So this is perfect.
Okay.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you very much for talking.